Welcome to Class Act, updates in education law. I'm Miriam.
I'm Lisa.
We're attorneys at Walter Haverfield in Cleveland. We practice school law. Every few weeks we get together, we talk about the most recent legal developments in education relevant to school boards, administrators, teachers, just anybody who works in education.
Yeah, and if you've been listening to our podcast for a while, you've noticed that we have a change in our name. We're really excited. The new name is Class Act. Same great podcast, just a new fun name.
All right, so today we are still talking a little bit about discipline. We're going to talk about manifestation determinations, and with us we have Christina Peer, a partner at Walter Haverfield. She's very experienced in working with school districts on special education issues when discipline is in play.
And thanks for joining us again, Christina.
Thanks for having me come back.
So as Miriam mentioned, today we are going to continue talking about discipline and specifically students with disabilities and the protections that are in place for them. If you remember last episode, we hit on the 10-day rule, and now we're going to talk about once you are past that 10-day rule, what needs to happen.
Manifestation determination reviews. That's the key point for this episode.
Super, super, super exciting, right? What everybody needs to know about manifestation reviews in 25 minutes or less, right? That's the goal here.
Let's do it.
All right. So do you guys want me to talk about just for a minute, like what is a manifestation review?
Yeah,
let's start
absolutely.
With that.
Let's start with that.
All right. So I think one of the things that people tend to do, they call them manifestation hearings. It's not a hearing. And I just want to start with that because it's so misleading. When you do a manifestation determination review, the team gets together. And when I say the team, I mean the student's IEP team. And I like to think of it as an IEP meeting with a really specific purpose. And the specific purpose of this IEP meeting is to determine whether or not the conduct that the student engaged in, you know, which is leading to this discipline, was related to or a result of their disability. That's all the team is getting together to consider. And I think sometimes parents have like a misperception that this meeting is to decide whether or not the student actually engaged in the conduct or not. And that's not what you're here for. That's
right. It's not a discipline hearing.
Right. Exactly. And that's why I said it's so important not to call it a hearing, because it's not. It's just a manifestation determination. And you're trying to decide whether or not, like I said, the student's conduct was related to or caused by their disability. So whether or not it was a manifestation of their disability.
And the second question I think that teams do need to look at is whether the conduct was a direct result of the district's failure to implement an IEP.
Absolutely.
And this is something not to just gloss over either and just assume, oh, no, we were implementing the IEP.
Yeah, no, and you know, we'll, I think as we talk about that a little bit more, you know, we all probably have some horror story of a district like glossing over that when really it was probably someone in the district's fault that the student behaved in the way they did.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know what else to say necessarily about, you know, the manifestation determination itself, you know, other than when you get together and you start to have this conversation, it's important for the team to really look at, all right, first, let's talk about what was the conduct. You know, what conduct did the student actually engage in? So you need to have somebody at the meeting who's familiar with all the facts and all the circumstances. You know, so let's say it was a fight. You know, so somebody who knows all about the fight. And again, it's important to make sure you say to the parents, for purposes of this meeting and this meeting only, we're going to assume that the fight actually happened and that your child was actually involved in it. Because
right.
Otherwise, you know, there's nothing to go off of.
Right. Avoid the debate of basically turning it into a disciplinary hearing of it
exactly.
Happened or it didn't happen. Take kind of the assumption, yes, it happened. And now we need to look at the student's needs, the student's eligibility, all the relevant factors about the student to determine if it was a manifestation of
Yeah, so I guess my question is, how does the team decide whether the student's conduct was a manifestation? What are the factors a team looks at?
So I think Christina hit it right with the first step is look at what was the actual incident that occurred that led to discipline.
Right, and then I think you have to look at what is the student's disability? And when I say that, I mean both what is the eligibility category under IDEA? You know, so what is the student identified as? Are they a student with autism? Are they a student with an emotional disability? Are they a student with a specific learning disability? But then you also have to look at what is the other information that we know about a student? You know, in Ohio, students on IEPs, you know, so students who are eligible under IDEA, are only allowed to have one eligibility category, even though they might have several different things that are going on. You still have to put them under one category. But for a manifestation determination, it's important to consider all of the different things that a student has, you know, that kind of plays into their profile. So maybe you have a student who is identified as a student with a specific learning disability because that covers most of their needs, but they've also been diagnosed with ADHD and depression and anxiety.
Right.
So you're not going to have all of that, you know, as their quote unquote diagnosis. You know, that's their specific learning disability. But you have to consider all of those things when you're doing the manifestation determination.
Right. So you really want to avoid simply looking at the label.
Right.
But it is a very important
consideration,
right.
Yeah. And
I
it's a starting point, right?
It's a starting point. I think the next step school districts typically do is look at the actual evaluation and what the examiner found in terms of the child's behaviors. What do the child's behaviors look like that led to the disability category?
Right. So in Ohio, your evaluation team report, and they're called different evaluation terms in other states, but that's going to be a very important starting point.
But we don't end it there.
Nope, not at all.
So sometimes we see districts who just say, okay, this is the disability category. This is what the ETR says from 2.5 years ago. But there's more to it than that. There's more to it than that. And what school districts should be looking at is all the information brought to the table by everyone. So if the parent shows up and says, okay, you know, so I understand the ETR talked about my child with a specific learning disability. She cannot read as well as other students. But look, it turns out she's actually got bipolar. And this was something we talked about with her psychiatrist a few weeks ago. And I did not bring it to the school's attention at that time. But now that we're having this manifestation determination, by the way, she's got bipolar.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You need to consider that for sure.
Absolutely. And it really does happen all the time. And I understand it from a parent's perspective, too, right? Some diagnoses like bipolar, take that, for example. I think they see it as, you know, it's kind of a personal thing. You know, there's a stigma that's associated with that. And maybe if I don't have to share it with the school, I don't really want to share it with the school. But when it starts to then impact and you've got this discipline situation, okay, well, now's the time I should share it because you need to know that my child is more than just a student with a specific learning disability. They have other challenges that they're facing as well.
Right. And also don't forget about those private evaluations that you might have gotten back a year or 2 years ago that maybe you didn't adopt all the findings in your evaluation team report, but you still need to be considering, or maybe there's another diagnosis in there, like you said, maybe some anxiety, depression, something else that might have played a factor at this point.
Hey, I have a question. Ladies, what happens if a parent just shows up with this information verbally? Does she have to bring something in writing from a doctor saying diagnosis bipolar, or can she just say it?
So IDEA doesn't say that you have to have anything in writing, you know, nor does it say that teams have to consider things that parents just bring up verbally. What I usually advise teams to do in that situation is to say to parents, you know, we're willing to take this into consideration, but we really need you to bring us something from the doctor. And if the parent says, well, I can't do that, then my advice to teams is, well, you know, we can't weight as heavily, mom, what you say without actually having something from the doctor. You know, so there's a little bit of consideration there, but I can't just accept at face value that your daughter has a diagnosis of bipolar simply because you told me that today.
Well, and I would also be careful not to just leave it at that, too. Certainly consider asking for a release to talk to that physician or something like that. So it's not just a one-time exchange of this information and then it's kind of put to the side because it was only given verbally.
Yeah. Right.
So I do want to point out it's a judgment call. It's a judgment call here. And if your team considers the parent reliable, if your team considers the parent credible, you do not need a formal written diagnosis to consider that child's disability. Whatever the parent brings to the table, you have to take a look at, and I think that what you should keep in mind is if this goes to hearing, how are you going to explain to the hearing officer why you found the parent not credible?
Right? I think that's a really good point. I think one of the things you consider with that is how does the student, you know, usually conduct themselves at school. So, you know, for something like bipolar, for example, it's not like you're not going to see perhaps signs or symptoms of that at school. So if teachers are also seeing that, I think that lends credibility to what the parent is saying, even if they don't come in with a diagnosis, you know, but you can also have the reverse, right? You have a situation where nobody at school has any idea about, this because the student isn't manifesting any of the symptoms at school. And I think that might lead you to, you said, it's a judgment call. You know, maybe we're going to put a little bit less credibility, you know, with what the parent said because we're not seeing it at school.
Well, and it may not even be fully credibility to the parent. It just may be looking at the facts specifically of the situation. Even should you agree that maybe that diagnosis is there and evident, it may not be relevant to the specific facts of the discipline. So your consideration and how in-depth that consideration goes is all going to be very fact-specific.
That's true. You know, I think that's the thing that makes manifestation determination so challenging because it is so fact-specific. You know, you're never going to have two cases that come out exactly the same way. You know, even if you have two students who are identified as students with autism who engage in exactly the same kind of misconduct, you know, you have to look at each student and their needs and their issues individually to make that determination. Is the misconduct that the student engaged in related to their disability? You know, is there a substantial relation there, or was the misconduct caused by the student's disability in some way?
Right. So really, you can have a possibility that a student with an emotional disability could have an incident that is not a manifestation of their disability, mm-hmm. but you could also have a student with a learning disability engage in something that very much is a manifestation.
Yeah.
So it just depends on what the circumstances are.
You know, I actually had one of those once. We had a student who was identified as a student with an emotional disturbance, and he engaged in a lot of behavior, but most of his behavior was very physically aggressive and acting out. And then one day he stole the teacher's wallet out of her purse and took some cash and credit cards. And when the team did the manifestation determination, they determined that it was not a manifestation of his disability because there was nothing in his history or in the ETR or anything that related to actually having sticky fingers and taking things that he shouldn't have, you know, because all of his emotional issues dealt with kind of this more acting out type of behavior. So just because a student has a label of emotional disturbance does not necessarily mean every single act of misconduct is going to result in it's a manifestation of their disability.
Right. And it's going to be really important to make sure you're going through this process of discussion and consideration of the whole situation.
Yeah, it's a long discussion process, or at least it should be. You know, I think one of the mistakes that districts make sometimes is they kind of try to just go like, boop, 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 let's go through the process really fast, right?
Check off the boxes, we're done.
Yeah, right, exactly. You know, without really going into a more full discussion of what's happening and why it's happening. And, you know, they treat it as just a, this is a box we need to check and something we have to do so we can move on to the next thing. But that really isn't how you should be looking at this.
I want to piggyback off of that and talk about the question, the second question, was the conduct a direct result of the district's failure to implement the IEP? I think...
Ooh, I've got a good story there too.
Okay.
Want to hear my good story there?
Yeah, go ahead.
So here's my good story for that one. We had a district and a student at one point who had a very, very specific behavior plan in place, and it was a student who had a lot of emotional issues. And part of the behavior plan dealt with how teachers were going to respond to him when he started to become escalated. And we had a teacher who had clearly either never read the behavior plan or didn't remember it or perhaps just completely disregarded it. Don't know which of the three it was. Don't really care. But what ended up happening is that the student became escalated. The teacher responded pretty much a textbook example of the opposite way they needed to respond, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So everything they did made the situation worse. And then the student ended up getting into an actual physical altercation where the teacher got hit. So when the team went back and did the manifestation determination, they had to look at what the teacher did because the teacher legitimately did not follow the student's plan. And everything that the teacher did actually made the situation worse.
Well, and we recognize that might be an uncomfortable conversation.
Oh, it was horrible.
But you got to have it.
You know, that's so funny, Christina, that you told us this story, because that's exactly what I was going to say. That's the example I was going to give. And I was going to say the same story.
See? So, yeah. And this, it happens. And I think districts need to be open. You know, administrators need to be open and directors of special education need to be open to the idea that sometimes our staff members don't do everything the right way. And like you said, as uncomfortable as it might be to kind of call them on it, you have to, because otherwise you're not going through the process in the way you need to, and you're just going to end up in legal trouble, frankly, because it was not this child's fault, you know, in that particular circumstance or instance. Most of the time you get to check that box and say, nope, it wasn't the district's fault because, you know, we didn't implement the IEP. You know, we've done what we needed to do. Sometimes there's an issue.
So we go through these meetings and we make a manifestation determination. Mm-hmm. So obviously it's either a manifestation or it's not.
Right.
So let's start with what if the team determines that it is not a manifestation?
That's easy. Relatively speaking, right? So if it's not a manifestation of the student's disability, they can be disciplined in the same manner as their non-disabled peer. And I want to be clear about that because a lot of times I get questions like, well, it's a student on an IEP or a student on a Section 504 plan, so there's some limitation, right, to how many days I can put them out. No, there's not. If it is not a manifestation of their disability, if a student would be expelled, you know, for up to 80 days for the same conduct that the student engaged in, and it's not a manifestation of their disability, they can also be expelled for 80 days if that's what the superintendent decides to do in that situation.
Does the school have to provide the same services that are on the child's IEP or accommodations on the 504 plan during that period?
So they have to provide services, but they don't have to look exactly the same. So I guess that's the caveat. It's not under, let's talk about IDEA, IEPs first. It's not really a true expulsion, if you will, because the student has to be educated in an interim alternative educational setting. You know, so what is that? It's some other way that they're going to receive all of their special education and related services without being at the high school, you know, for example. So it can be anything from home instruction to placement in like a separate facility day treatment setting where maybe there's more support for their behavioral and emotional needs. And the key point here is that the IEP team makes that determination.
When do they do that? When is this placement decided on?
Well, in my mind, you can do it two different ways. This gets a little bit convoluted. You can certainly make a decision after you do the manifestation determination. You know, so you're sitting there, you're at that same meeting, and you say, all right, we don't know yet what the disciplinary outcome is going to be, but let's just assume, you know, for the sake of argument, if the student were to be expelled, let's make a decision about what the interim alternative educational setting would be. And then if the superintendent decides not to expel the student, it's like no harm, no foul, right? We don't have to go forward with it because they're just going to come back to school because there was no discipline. Or you can say, well, let's wait and see what the superintendent decides. If you do it that way, then you've got to get the IEP team back together for a second meeting.
But the key point here is that at that hearing, when the superintendent makes the decision perhaps to expel the student, the superintendent as a sole individual is not deciding that interim placement.
Correct.
That is the IEP team's
decision. Sorry, superintendents out there.
Right. No, exactly. You know, it's kind of hard, right? Because sometimes superintendents want to make that decision. Sometimes building principals want to make that decision, right? If it's just a suspension, but you're over your 10 days. I've seen more letters than I care to count from building principals that say to a parent, you know, dear parent, your student is going to be suspended for 10 days. Because they're on an IEP, we're going to provide them with home instruction. Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
No.
And that's wrong on so many levels. We won't even go into it, you know, because the key point here is it's not the building principal's decision.
It's not the building principal's decision. It's the IEP team's decision. And sometimes I also see districts being too nice. The parent says, no, I don't like this. No, I don't like that setting. No,
yes.
I don't like home instruction. And I don't want this specialized school environment that you're offering. I'm going to take my time. I'm going to think about it. And I'll let you know. And then the school is just waiting. They're waiting for the parent to make the, maybe they're taking the parent to different settings, to different schools. In the meantime, the child is sitting at home.
Right.
Well, and this isn't your typical change of placement type of scenario either.
Right. So in Ohio, and Ohio is different than most states. You know, most states, parents don't have to consent to a change in placement because that's not part of federal law. In Ohio, parents have to consent to a change in placement, except in a circumstance where it's a disciplinary change in placement. So here, the IEP team can make that change to an interim alternative educational setting, even if the parent disagrees, you know, with what the team decided. You know, but I guess back to Miriam's point, you don't want to be too nice. Like, the team has to make a decision. You know, you can't just, like, let it go and let it go and let it go. Because you end up in a place then where the student is not actually getting what they need.
The hearing officer, the first question the hearing officer asks, and maybe I should preface this by saying a parent who's displeased with the outcome of the manifestation determination review can file a due process complaint.
Sure.
And the hearing officer, the first question in my experience the hearing officer asks is, where is the child being educated right now? where is the child going to school tomorrow? And if you are, if you're the district and your answer is, well, we were waiting for the parent to decide.
Yeah, not a good thing.
No, not good.
All right. So let's talk about then the other end of the spectrum of the team decides it is a manifestation.
Can I go back and hit one other thing very quickly? I made a distinction before between IDEA and Section 504 if it's not a manifestation of the student's disability. Under Section 504, districts are not required to provide any educational services to students after you determine that it's not a manifestation of a disability. So for a student on a 504 plan, an 80-day expulsion really can be 80 days without services.
And that's a good distinction.
It doesn't have to be.
And that makes sense because 504 plans are very often accommodations and modifications. And if the child's not in school, what are you accommodating?
Right. And 504 is a civil rights law as opposed to an education law. So there's no ability, I guess, or necessity under Section 504 to like reach a certain standard of educational achievement because that's not what it's supposed to do. You know, unlike IDEA, where we have to be able to demonstrate progress is being made.
Exactly.
All right. So sorry, Lisa, I got us off track.
No worries. That was a really good point to make. So we now have determined that the conduct is a manifestation. There are some things that have to happen now. Can you kind of take us through those?
Right. So when conduct is a manifestation of the student's disability, the first thing you need to know is that the student can't simply be disciplined like a typical peer. So they're going to come back to school. So if you issued a 10-day suspension and you were over the 10 days that we talked about, you know, your 10 free days, if you will, and the team meets for the manifestation determination on day 8 and decides that it is a manifestation of the student's disability, the very next day that student's coming back to school, even though technically they had some days of suspension that would have been left on their suspension, they have to come back. So that's really the first, you know, most important thing you have to know. You also have an obligation to conduct a functional behavior assessment. So the idea is this is a student who is misbehaving or having behavioral difficulties based on their disability. Let's try to get to the root of what's causing that behavior so we can then put better services and other things in place to address it so we don't just keep ending up in the same place, you know, with the student misbehaving and having disciplinary issues.
Right. So it's not working, don't keep doing the same thing.
Right.
Yes. Yes. So right? That's the definition of insanity, right?
Yeah. So out of that FBA, the team's also going to then develop a behavior intervention plan.
Probably yes. You do the functional behavior assessment. You can either develop a behavior intervention plan or you can go back and revise the student's IEP to put in very specific behavior goals, you know, that relate to whatever the conduct was that you were targeting. Something important to note about functional behavior assessments, they are considered by OSEP, the Office of Special Education Programming, the feds. They are considered to be an evaluation. So you have to have parental consent in order to do your FBA.
Well, and you know, you bring up a good point about talking about parental consent because I don't think we really hit on how important it is to have parental participation in this whole process.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. You know, parental participation is so important, but you also don't want to let parents, through their non-participation, lead you into procedural errors. You know, it's kind of like Miriam was talking about. Sometimes you're too nice, right? You're trying to get to a point where everybody's in agreement and we can all sing kumbaya and everything is lovely.
Too nice backfires.
Too nice.
Yes,
almost always. You know, so one of the things you have to be cognizant about is the timing for your manifestation determination review. It needs to be done within 10 school days of the discipline that takes you over, you know, into your day 11, if you will. So when it takes you over that 10 days, I've had districts get in trouble because parents are like, well, I can't come in. And then they've blown the deadline for the manifestation determination review because they're trying so hard to accommodate the parent's schedule. And then after they blow the deadline, the parent comes back and says, well, you blew the deadline. You're like, but wait a minute.
Yep, right.
So send your invitations, document your conversations with parent trying to schedule with them and include them.
Right.
And have the meeting.
You know, if the parent keeps just trying to push it back and push it back, go ahead and have the meeting. And if you do end up in a situation where the parent says, well, now I want to come in, you can have the meeting again. You know, you can kind of do a redo, if you will, to look at what the parent wants to say, but you've at least had the meeting within the right time frame.
And I just want to point out to our audience, I'm sure many of you are familiar with the issues we just talked about, but if you are sitting or driving or mowing your lawn and you're wondering what is an FBA, what is a BIP, what does that specifically involve, I think Christina, we'll do maybe a separate episode on the specifics of a functional behavior analysis and behavior intervention plan, what that looks like, what the common pitfalls are. So watch out for that in a future episode.
Great. So anything anybody else wants to touch on today before we wrap up? Because I know this is really a complex issue. We'll have another episode where we can talk about some unique circumstances and problems that we've encountered that we haven't talked about yet today.
Yeah, there are some exceptions for weapons and drugs, and I think we'll go into those details next time. In the meantime, thank you so much for tuning in. Thanks so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this. Send us an email. Let us know what you think. And as always, give us a great rating on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcast.
And thanks for joining us, Christina.
Thanks for having me.
The content of this podcast is provided for general information purposes only. The podcast is not legal advice, does not create an attorney-client relationship, and should not be relied upon in making legal decisions. Actions on legal matters should be taken only upon advice of legal counsel. Walter Haverfield does not guarantee the accuracy of information contained in this podcast.